The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield, and The Money Show is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that's unearthing limitless potential at Mining Indaba 2020. That's African Asset. APSA is a registered FSP. We've got our guests lined up for Monday for our special outside broadcast from the Mining Indaba. It's a big event that comes to Cape Town every year, and it's been an event which has been incredibly gloomy for a long period of time. Lots of uncertainty, lots of circumspection. Lots of worries about the state of the mining sector. But in the last year, certainly the platinum sector has had a stellar time, courtesy of huge rallies in the underlying value of those commodities. We'll chat to Andre de Reiter in just a moment, new chief executive at Eskom, Matthew Davies from the BBC on Brexit, David Peacock from Sanlam Private Wealth, our market commentator after a terrible week on markets, not only here but worldwide. Some of the best bits from The Money Show, and wrapping it up with a brutal biz quiz this evening on The Money Show.
Bruce Whitfield on 702. Call Bruce on 011-883-0702.
We're going to summarize what the Eskom chief executive Andre de Reiter was saying when he delivered a media briefing this morning on the state of the grid and his plan for the fix. It's going to get worse before it gets better. That's the summary. We're going into an extended period of power cuts, and the price of energy we consume will go up. Andre de Reiter is with us this evening. Do you have a handle, Andre, on Eskom, what, a month into your tenure?
Calling it a firm handle, Bruce, at this point in time, I think is a bit early. I'm learning, I'm picking up, but I believe that we as a management team here at Eskom understand what the major issues are, and we've got plans to address those major issues.
What's your overall assessment of the state of the utility?
Eskom is in crisis, but it can be fixed, and that's what we intend to do.
Okay, fixed from a balance sheet perspective, fixed from a financial perspective, from a profitability perspective, or from an operational perspective, or on all fronts?
We need to do all of those things, Bruce. If we want to build a sustainable, profitable electricity utility in South Africa, we need to address, first of all, our plants, bring operational sustainability and predictability back into the system, and that's why we need to do catch-up maintenance. We need to look at our income statement, collect the debts that are due to us, improve our total gross margin and our revenue, and then we need to look at the balance sheet and also the structure of the organization.
I mean, everyone I speak to has taken over as chief executive of practically anything in the last 2 years is appalled by the state of what they find when they go inside. If you look at where the way SARS was denuded of skills, if you look at the way in which the Public Investment Corporation was denuded, if you look at EOH and multiple listed companies, the mess at Edcon, for example, people are horrified but why what they find when they open the front door on day one. Were you appalled by what you discovered? Was it better, worse, the same as you anticipated before you went in?
Look, I think there are significant challenges at Eskom, and they've been well publicized. The legacy of capture and corruption still alive and still having a big negative impact on the organization, both from a financial, operational, as well as from a company morale perspective. But I must say that the people that I've met at Eskom are still very proud of the organization. They work incredibly hard, much harder than in the private sector, I might add, and put in the hours to keep the lights on. So there's a core here of skill and commitment that I think is a tremendous asset that we can work with.
And to that point, you can't fix it yourself. You do need a team that not only has got the technical know-how, but a team that you can actually trust. Have you got that team? Is that team set in stone? Are you looking to bring more talent in?
No, I think we will be restructuring the top team. We will bring in some additional talent. I think there are portfolios that have not received the necessary attention and also seniority. So we will be looking at bringing in those top skills when we can find them.
What guarantees have you got from government, from Pravin Gordhan, who's your minister of reference, from your board, that there's going to be no interference. You put down a plan. You said, here's the, I'm sure it's a rough outline of what we need to do and how we need to achieve it. And here's a timeline of what we need to do, that you're not going to be interfered with in the process of trying to rescue this utility, which is the backbone of everything in South Africa right now.
Okay, I think there are two types of political interference. The first type is the interference that you get from a concerned shareholder. And having been on the other side of the fence in the private sector, it's not unusual to get a call from a concerned shareholder saying, you know, your performance is not what we require, please come and explain. And that is certainly a legitimate form of interference, intervention, supervision, if you will. The other type of political interference, which is completely unacceptable, is the type that has characterized Eskom for a long period of time, which is, please award contract X to my mate Y because of the political connections.
And I'm taking it that there is a line, and that's the line, is it?
Absolutely. That is the line, and if I get requests to that effect, then that's a line that I will not cross.
And also, the fact that you're looking at civil prosecutions and you're looking at civil cases against people who've been caught up in malfeasance at Eskom is a smart, fast-track way of dealing with some of the legacy issues that you're inheriting. I mean, is that a strategy that you're prepared to fund in order to hold to account people who've come before you who have pillaged the organization?
Well, the rate of return that you can get from pursuing these claims is very attractive indeed. The legal costs pale into insignificance relative to the amounts of money that can potentially be recovered. We're obviously working very closely with the SIU on this. The SIU has a mandate to pursue civil claims, and we're working very closely with them, and they are being tremendously helpful in recovering those amounts.
I mean, a huge amount of frustration. We all feel it as South Africans. And Richard Quest, in his now famous interview that we did in Davos, was very outspoken about when is somebody going to go to jail? And Eskom strikes me as an ideal place to find at least one candidate who might spend some time in jail.
Look, so Eskom obviously doesn't have powers to arrest people. But we are working very closely, as I said, with the SIU, also with the Hawks. We've already seen two arrests of former Eskom executives in December, and I've got every reason to believe that we can expect more arrests in the near future.
Question on our SMS line. In simple terms, the purpose of dividing up Eskom into the three bits, into generation, transmission, and distribution. This predates you, but you've come out in support of the divisionalization of Eskom. In simple terms, what purpose does it serve?
So there are two reasons here. The first reason is to enable me to get my arms around the organization. If you aggregate everything up to the highest level, it's very difficult to manage an organization, particularly when you've got three very disparate businesses with very different drivers. So divisionalizing it, and this is very common practice in corporates all over the world, gives management greater line of sight and greater accountability. So that's from a management effectiveness point of view. More importantly, though, as South Africa's energy sector changes, we need to be able to give assurance to private sector investors in the generation sectors, the so-called IPPs, that their bids and their electricity prices will be fairly and independently considered and not prejudiced when competing against an incumbent Eskom generation facility. And that is the major reason why the legal separation, eventually, once we've established separate income statements, once we've got a business model going, why that is a prerequisite for a more efficient and more effective and more competitive electricity sector.
We've all been lied to, we've all been deceived on multiple fronts for an awfully long time in South Africa. We've been told by several of your predecessors, this time it's going to be different, this time we've got a handle on it, this time it's going to be better. Why is this time going to be different?
We are very aware of the fact that we operate from a huge trust deficit, not only with regard to South Africa, but also with regard to our government, our shareholder, our lenders, even our people internally. So restoring that trust can only be done by delivery against our targets. So we recognize absolutely that we can't appeal to people to trust us. We have to earn that trust, and that is what we have to earn through delivery.
André de Ruyter, Chief Executive at Eskom, 400 and 454 billion rands worth of debt at last count on the balance sheet of Eskom, a broken electricity system, a electricity system that regularly suffers breakdowns, an electricity system that's being held together with sticky tape, bubblegum and occasionally strands of hair, an electricity system that is incredibly vulnerable. Brace yourself for load shedding 3.7 or whatever version we're on at the moment, 18 months at least of load shedding. Hopefully it's carefully structured, hopefully it's sensitively structured and it doesn't interfere too much with your getting to and from work, your experience at home, because the last thing you want when you get home is that your home is in pitch darkness. There's got to be a mechanism for smart operating, and you know, hopefully André de Ruyter is the guy who can stick it out and to turn around the monstrosity that has become Eskom.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious.
It's been coming for 3 years and finally Brexit is actually here. Matthew Davies is with us. Matthew is an editor at BBC's Africa Business Report. He is the editor of the BBC Africa Business Report. It's Brexit Day, Matthew Davies. It felt like a day that would never come. Slowly, slowly, then suddenly you leave the EU. What time?
We leave the EU at 11 o'clock tonight, our time, which is midnight in Brussels. And, of course, that's about 1 o'clock, your time.
And is the world coming to an end when everybody wakes up and so suddenly there won't be bacon on the tables because the Danes would have refused to export it to Britain? Is it calamity or is it business as usual?
It's not calamity. I fully expect to have my Danish bacon sandwich tomorrow morning. The nothing really changes. Life will go on tomorrow as it did today. We're now into the transition stage. We now have until the end of the year, until we actually really leave the machinery of the European Union, and we have to negotiate a new trade deal with our closest European partners. So at the moment, everything stays the same. We are still subject to European laws. We are still paying into the system. We don't have a say anymore at the table. It's a bit like being at a party. So the UK is leaving and has actually been leaving for 3 years. But we're sort of standing in the hallway going, we're going, bye. And at the moment, everybody, all the Europeans are still dancing. They're going, yeah, see you later. And at the moment, we haven't actually gone through the door. We're standing in the hallway still clutching our bottle of wine.
The only entity that seems really concerned about the uncertainty that persists around what Britain will look like outside of the European Union when the divorce, I mean, this is like the separation ahead of the divorce, and the divorce happens at the end of the year. The Bank of England expressing its concerns about the great unknowns, simply because there are so many unknowns as to how the relationship into the future is going to be negotiated and where the power is going to sit in those negotiations.
This is the thing, isn't it? I mean, we just don't know going forward. So we're actually almost more uncertain now as we head towards the end of the year than we were, say, 3 years ago. So the uncertainty certainly hasn't gone away. I mean, that's really the only certainty that we have. But it's even predictions, like, I mean, the Bank of England was making dire predictions after the referendum 3 years ago, saying that, you know, there'll be millions of loss, or half a million jobs will go. And we haven't seen that yet. But, of course, you know, we are now in this transition phase, and unless the UK and the UK government and trade negotiators can come up with a good deal which puts the UK where it needs to be trade-wise, you know, anything could happen.
Politically, Boris Johnson is the strongest prime minister since Tony Blair, probably. And he's got a huge amount of leeway, I suppose, in these negotiations. He's been talking up Brexit. His cabinet's been talking up Brexit. So Sajid Javid, your Chancellor of the Exchequer, talking up the opportunity of Brexit. Does the great British public, or at least 52% of the greater British public, which voted in favour of leaving the European Union, believe the politicians?
Does anybody believe politicians anywhere in the world? I suppose they do. I suppose you do to some extent. I mean, you know, they now have the task of, you know, making Britain's place in the trading world as good for people who live in the United Kingdom as possible. Whether they can do that, I mean, let's face it, trade negotiators from the UK are very used to being, you know, having the big brother behind them, being part of the big gang, the big European gang. And now outside it, it may seem a very different sort of playground for them.
Matthew Davies, thank you very much. He is editor of the BBC Africa Business Report from London this evening, giving us perspective on Brexit. Business as usual, until it's not anymore.
The Money Show. The markets.
I think this is a joke. At least I hope it's a joke. I'd like to thank SAA and Eskom for protecting us from the coronavirus. Thanks to them, nobody wants to or can travel to South Africa. Justin, I think it's a joke, Justin. I hope it's a joke. David Peacock, he is a portfolio manager at Sundown Private Wealth, and coronavirus has suddenly become the big issue. It's, you know, 240 deaths in China and some outbreaks in various parts of the world. And the world's gone completely and utterly bananas, David Peacock, over an illness that is more threat than substance at this stage.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce.
It's the other button, David. I'm not too sure why you're talking into the vacuum.
Okay, David. How's that,
That's
Bruce?
Now it feels like you're in my ears.
It was like an SAA flight. It didn't take off.
No. Let's not pick on SAA unnecessarily. There are plenty of good reasons to pick on them.
Okay.
Coronavirus has taken the world by storm.
Yeah, so it is a sort of one of the big, or one the third if at the moment, specifically in terms of South Africa, because it looks like there's been a confirmed case or a possible case in Botswana, so that's now starting to move it a lot closer to our border. I think the sort of difficulty here is just in terms of estimating what the impact of this is going to be, you know, on the world and obviously South Africa. So I suppose the only way you can really sort of compare this is if you were to look at, for example, the SARS virus that was out in sort of 2003. And if you go back and look at that, you know, you would see that basically it took about a quarter of the year for that to sort of reach maturity and sort of, you know, move on. And then you obviously saw the reduction of deaths and the containment coming through and that sort of thing. So in terms of that, you know, what do we sort of have a view of the sort of implications? So clearly the most simple sort of change is that you would have a change of behavior in terms of things, for example, travel, tourism, and discretionary spending. So those are really the sort of difficulties in terms of determining from a China slash America slash Europe, what are the sort of implications that are going to happen? And if you look at the sort of Wuhan area, it only really accounts for sort of 1.5 to 1.6% of China's GDP. However, that province sort of, you know, takes up sort of makes up 4-odd% impact in terms of Chinese GDP. So really, it's going to be a case of seeing. The good news, I think, is the fact that they've been able to spread the word in terms of this is an issue, and it looks like it's being contained globally at the moment, whether it be a ship off the coast of Italy or aeroplanes that are coming through and people being put in sort of 2 weeks confinement. It looks like there is a very, very strong attack on this virus and a containment of it. So from that perspective...
But markets are behaving like this is a tsunami coming to take over the world. And maybe it's just markets looking for an excuse to pull back, because around the world, we just look at valuations and share markets and they always need a reason. The Rand is one of those victims, and the JSE... Like other global markets, has had a torrid week.
Well, absolutely. And unfortunately, we've had a perfect storm. So Andre de Ruyter has a massive task on his hands in terms of dealing with the current Eskom and then the issue of dividing it up so that they can actually clearly see exactly where the proper expenditure is being used efficiently, etc. Then we've had the coronavirus, which is now a global issue, and then obviously Brexit this evening, which also causes the sort of uncertainty in terms of exactly what's going to be happening and that sort of thing. So it has been a very frustrating week in the market. We were up sort of 3.5% for the year to date, literally a week ago, and today I think we're down about 1.5% for the year. So it's been a frustrating start to the year that has been January.
Talk about frustrations. Explain Sasol, please. I mean, you can buy Sasol at prices today that you would have paid in 2008.
Yeah.
Global financial crisis times. I mean, Sasol has just been an unmitigated disappointment for years.
Yeah, I think that unfortunately this Lake Charles issue has, like any other mega project, has unfortunately taken much longer than expected. It's come up with a lot of problems that weren't expected, and has cost a lot more than anticipated. So as a mega project, it looks like the management that was in place at that particular time didn't have an effective hold on what is happening. It appears that the new management knows what they're doing, and I put that in brackets. And ultimately, you get the feeling in terms of what we saw today is that there's almost a case of kind of kitchen sinking in terms of we'll load everything into here, and from here on we should start seeing, you know, things improving. And in many respects, it looks like the general sentiment is that a lot of the negatives are already priced into the share, given that it was down a further 7% today. So from that perspective, what do we need to look at going forward? It's obviously what's going to happen to this oil price. So will we see that moving firmer from this level? And then obviously in terms of the chemicals. And what we did see in terms of their production updates is that this fire that they experienced just recently didn't have the sort of massive knock-on effect to the downstream production of Sasol. So from an investment point of view, you almost get the feeling that, hold on a second, maybe we are seeing the worst out of Sasol now, and possibly you're starting to see a bottom in the share price at these levels.
Well, I like your optimism, David, but I mean, that Andre de Ruyter openly admits to the fact that South Africa, there's a trust deficit in Eskom, and they've got to work hard to get it back. In companies like Sasol, there's a massive trust deficit as well. We've lost faith in companies, their management teams. They've told us things for years that haven't come to fruition, and frankly, they've got to work blooming hard to regain some public trust. This is a one-time market darling that has fallen so far from grace, we don't even remember Grace's face.
Bruce, what do you want me to say to that?
I just want you to say, yes, you're absolutely right. And then I'll say, thank you, David Peacock, portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. He's not often lost for words, you know.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that's unearthing limitless potential at Mining Indaba 2020. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Best bits coming up in just a little while, including that critical discussion that we had with the Development Bank of South Africa last night, getting saying, please, will you just explain? Please explain the mechanism for lending money to SAA. You're the Development Bank of South Africa, not the Airline Bailout Bank of South Africa. Coming up on your next Money Show, we're taking a deep dive into the state of mining with a special panel discussion. Sibanye Stillwater Chief Executive Neil Froneman, the Bushveld Mineral CEO Fortune Mojabelo, APSA CIB Shirley Weber, and mining analyst Peter Major in an all-singing, all-dancing, star-studded lineup of everybody who is anybody in the mining industry. Coming up on your next Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious.
See a tweet from Richard Calland, the political analyst this evening, and he's saying that Angela Merkel's visit to South Africa next week has been officially confirmed by Berlin. She's going to be accompanied by a high-powered business delegation, and Angela Merkel will meet President Cyril Ramaphosa next week, which is really good news. There's a good sense also that there's a lot more goodwill building, growing interest from Germany in South Africa, getting cooperation going, and any cooperation, any deals, as long as Cyril Ramaphosa doesn't say, Africa loves you, Angela. Then everything will be fine. But that's what is going to be happening next week. We'll keep an eye on the Germans coming to town. But first, let's pick up on some of the best bits of the week that was on The Money Show. The ruling party, that's the African National Congress, just in case you've forgotten, proposing to remove the courts as a decider when it comes to land expropriation. It's a massively contentious issue, of course. Bulelwa Mabasa, member of the President's Land Reform Advisory Panel, also directed Worksmen's Attorneys, spoke to us about the importance of really understanding and asking the right questions when it comes to this highly contentious issue.
the right question needed to be asked before this parliamentary process was, what is the cause of the slow pace of land reform?
Correct.
And had that been the question, we would have come to a potentially different conclusion.
But and an embarrassing conclusion, so it wasn't a question the government wanted asked, because it's messed up the process radically over time.
Absolutely. And this is what happens when politics overtake the law, Bruce. Because if this was a purely illegal inquiry, which it isn't, we would probably be left with a situation where we are fixing all the wrongs of land reform that go into, go into lack of political will, corruption, and just complete, ineptitude. But if you're going to, because land reform is not just a legal issue, it's an issue that requires social justice. It's an issue that is felt by millions of people in South Africa. If the question is asked, is the Constitution an impediment? The answer that you're going to get is a very highly charged, an emotionally charged answer. So unfortunately, when it comes to land reform, it's not a simple question of, what is the legal jargon that is best to be used. Unfortunately, it's just one of those things that is a metaphor for all the failings, or most of the failings in the country.
Thank you to Bulelwa Mabasa from Worksmen's Attorneys. Well, this weekend, if you manage to find a reference on the Development Bank of South Africa website to bailing out airlines as part of its mandate, I'm sure we can find a pen or a coffee cup or a nice notebook for you to scribble in or something as a prize, because I looked. I couldn't find it. I scoured the Development Bank of South Africa website and I couldn't find it anywhere. But 3.5 billion rand making its way from the Development Bank into the coffers of SAA. It's got a government guarantee to it, but SAA has burned through 20 billion rands in taxpayer money over the last 3 years alone. And so we had to challenge Zodwa Mbele, the group executive for transacting at the Development Bank of South Africa, to say, hold on a second, surely this was a political decision.
It wouldn't be a political decision. DBSA has got a board. We followed our own governance processes in terms of the investment committee, where management presides over that. Thereafter, it went to the board, and our board is very much independent of the shareholder. By the way, just for your information as well and for the listeners' benefit, it is the DPE who is the shareholder even here. It's not National Treasury. DBSA reports to National Treasury. SAA reports to DPE. So the concurrence, yes, of the guarantee comes from National Treasury, concurring what the DPE minister would have requested. So let's just make it very, very clear that it's not a direct lending in any way. And even in the governance processes, as you possibly know, if you are familiar with investment decisions, it's not science, it's art, isn't it? And therefore, we all have different avenues to come to some consensus of some sort. You may like the deal, I may not like the deal. But obviously we need to convince each other why we need to do a deal. So it's just typical in any investment. So there's no misstep in terms of the governance.
When do you expect government then to pay you back, and are you charging them interest?
Yeah, of course. The deal has gone through market-related terms. If you are familiar with DBSA, DBSA has got bonds, will raise funding in the market, in the capital market. Asset managers fund DBSA. So we don't get any government injection necessarily. So we have to do any business at an arm's length with any other SOE. We've done the same with with Eskom. It's not something that is new. And it's market-related. We need to be paid out. It's not really that we have maybe free money from somewhere.
What is the duration of the loan then?
It's a short-term facility that is due to expire in 6 months' time.
Effectively, it's government lending to government. And the mechanism is via the Development Bank of South Africa. Zodwa Mbele from the Development Bank. Oh, she corrected me 6 times and I'm still going to get it wrong. But I'll make Money Monday special edition guest this week, Julia Anastatopoulos. Close enough. She told us about growing up in a middle-class family, being creative when parents had real jobs like engineers and teachers. And I asked her whether or not she was any good at all. Suzelle DIY, in case you're wondering who Julia is, with money.
Suzelle is actually quite good with money. Look, as a business, we've definitely made mistakes and we're still learning in terms of building a business and building a brand. But we are slowly figuring things out, and we've found a way for Suzelle to make us money. And as a result, we've now started a production company, Sketchbook Studios, which has really opened a lot of doors. Suzelle has opened a lot of doors for us financially and otherwise.
So has Ari given up his day job, and his day job is now Suzelle?
Yes. Well, not Suzelle, but Suzelle is one of the things that we do. Sketchbook, yeah, exactly. So Sketchbook is what we do, and we produce all kinds of content.
But Suzelle is the catalyst for Sketchbook,
exactly.
Which is the catalyst for a serious business.
Exactly. That's it. Can you believe it?
That's very good. Are you any good with managing money long term for the future? Do you have boring things like retirement annuities?
I do have a retirement annuity.
What? An actor with a retirement annuity?
It was the one thing I did. It was the one thing I did, and I feel good about it, the retirement annuity. But that's one of the few things. I'm really trying hard to be better at it and to learn more and invest more. I'm quite intimidated by the world of investment.
Is what she was going to say. And that's Suzelle, DIY. Very, very famous. And she's quite good at DIY as well. Real DIY done goofily. And they're going to make a movie. I hope they make money out of the movie. I really do. Brutalbiz quiz time. The coronavirus. Now, it's derived from the word corona. It's a Latin word. What does corona mean? It doesn't mean beer. But there's a clue on the bottle. If you have one in your hand right now and can string a sentence together, 011-883-0702-021-446-0567 on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that's unearthing limitless potential at Mining Indaba 2020. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The Money Show.
The Brutal Biz Quiz.
The name coronavirus derived from a Latin word, as so many words are. The Latin word is corona. What does corona mean, David?
Hello, Bruce. It's a crown in Latin.
Okay, crown. Or another word could be halo, but yes, crown most certainly. The characteristic appearance of the virus particles. They have a fringe reminiscent of a royal crown or the solar corona. That's a bit brief applause, audience. The new coronavirus has today been declared a global emergency by the World Health Organization. Which YouTube character was created by Julia Anastasiadopoulos?
Was created by Junior. I didn't get the rest of it.
And nor did I. Anastatopoulos, I think.
It's entirely possible.
Anastatopoulos. I mean, she's very good at the drill.
Very good at the SpongeBob.
No, not SpongeBob, I'm afraid. Julia didn't create SpongeBob. Amelia, don't make me say her name again, but Julia, she's so nice, and she was very tolerant of my mispronunciation of her name. She's the person behind a YouTube character that they're making a movie about, and she did lots of things that would fix stuff in your home.
I don't know. I'm sorry, Bruce.
You're not part of the YouTube generation. Oh, my goodness gracious me. George, put us out of our misery.
It's Suzelle DIY.
Suzelle DIY. She was our Make Money Mondays guest this week. What has given SAA a R3.5 billion lifeline?
The DBSA.
The loan secured this week with a government guarantee. What did Klaus Schwab start? George, I'm afraid not. He didn't. He didn't. Klaus Schwab started something big. It's 50 years old. It's not Spur or Pick and Pay. Or Clicks, I think it's about 50 years old as well. Multiple things have turned 50 recently. It was a good year 50 years ago. What did Klaus Schwab start? Colin Cullis was explaining its relevance to us in our Business Unusual feature this week. 011-883-0702-021-446-0567 if you'd like to play this evening's Brutal Biz Quiz.
The Money Show.
The Brutal Biz Quiz.
Wrapping up the Biz Quiz this evening, Klaus Schwab started something 50 years ago. Vusi, what was it?
It's the World Economic Forum, Bruce.
The World Economic Forum that meets in Davos, and this year the World Economic Forum Africa in Addis Ababa. The company which makes Coo baked beans was founded in 1921 by Jacob Frankel. What is the name of the company today?
I got no idea. Sorry, Bruce.
You don't know who makes Coo baked beans, Vusi?
No idea, Bruce.
I must tell them about, talk to them about their branding. I must talk to them about their branding. They make all gold as well. No, we don't make all gold. Let's make a brand called All Gold. 011-883-0702-021-446-0567. It would be illegal to make all gold. They also picked a fight with a little restaurant in Cape Town last year, and I was very cross with them for that. Lyndon?
Pioneer Food.
It's the other one, Lyndon. It's the other one. Am I not going to have a Wizard of the Brutal Biz quiz this evening? Coo baked beans. All gold tomato sauce. What else do they make? They make Beacon chocolate. Eddie?
Beaches. Yes.
Beaches. What?
No, I didn't say Beaches. I thought it was Heinz.
You were thought wrong, I'm afraid, Eddie. Oh, this is so much more fun than I thought it would be. So Jacob Frankel, in 1921, starts a company which last year would have celebrated 100 years. But unfortunately, they had a cloud hanging over them. It's a listeriosis cloud hanging over them. You have 15 seconds. And I'm afraid nobody's getting it. Oh, what a disaster. We don't have a Wizard of the Biz quiz. I, for once, get one over you. Unless I get a quick winner this evening. And let's see if we can get a quick winner. Who's that? Terence.
It's me.
Terence. Which company is it?
It's Tiger Brands.
Oh, thank goodness. But I can't make you the Wizard of the Biz quiz with just one answer. Which company wishes it didn't have a project at Lake Charles in Louisiana?
Sure. That one, unfortunately, I can't answer, Bruce.
I mention it like 500 times a day. You don't listen, Terence, so that hurts my feelings. It's Sasol. Terence, you're not the Wizard of the Biz quiz. I've got one over you. That is it from The Money Show for this evening and for this week. Thank you for playing. Good night.